You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
It is time for Family Matters, and joining us again this week is Zama Mbele, who's a clinical psychologist, and he was here, you will remember, a couple of weeks ago. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me again.
What are we going to talk about today?
Well, I suppose very many things, though we're going to use the segue of adoption as a conversation starter, I suppose. And I was just saying that while there are very many different ways to manage this conversation, I've seen in my experience that there are conversations to be had around the parents or the parentals who are adopting and what happens for them, including the intentions and motivations. Though perhaps where we might bear some focus today is what happens to the kids and the kiddies that are adopted, and how does adoption kind of manifest in their life all the way from zero through to when they're grandparents. It's something that's ever present, and things can go terribly wrong. And at the same time, it can be a really great opportunity to have them have a great experience with life as opposed to not being adopted.
Obviously, you've worked with some kids and some families who are in this scenario. I don't know beyond that, Zama, how much research you have done about adoption in general, but it just occurred to me that maybe a good starting point is, and we'll ask our listeners as well, obviously, I wonder what South Africans' attitudes are towards adoption in general. How do we compare whether that kind of thing even exists as a data point?
It's a very interesting data point, and it's more present than we would imagine. The tricky part is that it's not always called adoption. So if we look at some of the research on migration and immigration in our history, and where you had grandparents having to adopt, in inverted commas, that's very present there. All the way through to the more philosophical, historical conversations around belonging and places of belonging, and who adopts who. Does a person adopt a place geographically and socially, or does, or vice versa? So, and there's also a lot of research and dialogues in between those polarities. When it comes specifically to adoption in South Africa, there is perhaps much less information, much less, which is a pity, which is why we've had to be a lot more creative in looking and thinking around where else can we find it.
Okay, so give us a call if you've got questions for our clinical psychologist. Perhaps you are going through adoption, maybe you have fears, difficulties that you haven't been able to puzzle through. Also, if you've been in a family where you were adopted, what has been your experiences? Do share those with us as well. The lines will be open throughout on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. I don't even know where one begins to think about what the factors are that you should consider if you are thinking about adoption. I would imagine for many families that think about the formal adoption processes, the desire to adopt may simply in the first instance stem from a desire to parent and maybe to have a kid. And then suddenly you find yourself in this complicated paperwork and things. How does it work?
I mean, it's vastly complicated. And you mentioned the desire to become parents, which is certainly a big component on why people adopt. Now, it's not the only desire oftentimes. And one of the distinctions that we like to make is, do you want to be a parent or do you want to have a child? And those have such nuances in distinctions. And when that question is posed to very many people, it can be puzzling for a lot of people, you know, wanting to be a parent, wanting to give something, wanting to bring a child up and give something of your own is slightly different to almost occasionally a possessive wanting of a child. And then we can further debunk that. What do you mean when you say you want a child? And one of the important considerations specifically that we might make in the line of thinking that I come from is, what about yourself wants to adopt? What about, you know, is it an economic exercise, which can actually be reparative and in amongst other things? Is it purely psychological, and are there inherences from your childhood, almost wanting to replay and relive and remake things? Is it a lot more about adulthood and where you are and where you should be, and therefore wanting to equate? So as you can imagine, there are more options than not in really thinking about it. Now, what's occasionally missed is who it is that you're adopting and where it is that you're going to go there. Now, I've just focused quite a lot on the person who's doing an adoption or the adoption. And of course, in that, it includes their family.
Yeah.
Though what must not be missed is what it is that the person or the child and the kid and eventually the adult who is going to be adopted will gain from this. And will they, in fact, gain, which is not always easy to bear focus on.
Look, you've said so many brilliant things that I want to pause over some of them. The different motivations that someone might have when they set out to adopt. Why does it matter?
Well, I suppose,
for example, your distinction between the desire to have a kid and the desire to have a parent, which intrigues me. I assume that we don't, I don't know, I mean, you're the expert here, but are some motivations ones that should be red flags?
Absolutely. Look, there's no motivation which is better than another, though we do know that there are some motivations which are more damaging than others. That's the first place. Secondly, either way, with any motivation, to the extent that one really thinks about it and debunks it and gets into it, then it becomes much lesser the motivation that you will indulge as much as the relationship and the child that you will have. And to kind of bring it back a little bit, one of the things we see is that people oftentimes want to be mothers or want to have children because they want to fulfill something of their own stuff. Then it's not really helpful in the relationship, and it's also not really helpful for the child. In fact, it can be incredibly damaging. And it is not as if once we work through those things, you can come to a point where you do eventually have a child, and you have them for who they are and not so much for the gulf or the intention or the desire or the hunger that you might have had.
But can I be a little bit naughty? I mean,
please.
I've always thought it is interesting how he set the bar right up there when it comes to adoption.
Mm.
And there should be a minimum threshold.
Absolutely.
You need to be able to obviously feed, clothe, love. There needs to be psychosocial wellness that can be reasonably guaranteed by the person assessing you for adoption. All of that I get. But, you know, sometimes I think, okay, this so-and-so is pregnant. They weren't very happy over the last couple of years. And the child breathes new life into their relationship. So if couples who can, you know, have kids just through natural means often have a range of motivations, including very selfish ones, including just trying to breathe new life into their relationships, why are we so purist about a smaller range of optimal motivations when it comes to the formal adoption process?
It's an unfair discrimination. And the short answer is that is because we can. And it is a pity that actually with an organic kind of birth and having a child, we cannot step in. And boy, would I love it if we could, really for the couple or for the parent and single parents, as much as for the child there too. It's just that unfortunately in this particular process, there can be an intervention in place that can help them think. And sometimes it can have some malice in it, which is once again a pity, and it should not.
Okay. If you've got questions about adoption, give us a call. What has been your experiences? How difficult has it been? And on this question of hurdles, what have you gone through? I know couples who've struggled with adoption agencies, for example. What have been your experiences of the system? 011-883-0702. That is our Johannesburg number. And of course, in Cape Town, you can give us a call on 021-446-0567. My guest is clinical psychologist Zamo Mbelo is with us. And you can hear that, obviously, as always, he's got some fascinating insights around some of these phenomena.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
But it's before 11, and in this week's Family Matters, we're talking about adoption and all its complexities. And with me in the studio is Zamo Mbelo. You can give us a call on 011-883-0702 in Joburg. If you've got a question, share your experiences. What has been your experience of this system? And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Identity politics in this country refuses to go out of fashion. Doesn't help that people like Eusebius keep punting identitarian politics, but it is the reality of our country. Shall we talk a little bit about different families? You have mostly black kids, just numerically, who are often adopted. And sometimes you have to deal with the dynamics that come with cross-racial and other cross-isms forms of adoption.
And I'm glad that identity politics does not go away, because I think that it is a very important political conversation to have. And when it comes to adoptions, boy, is it so present, both from the parent's position as well as from the adopted child and eventually adult. And it can get incredibly complicated. And there is no how-to manual, unfortunately, and somewhere fortunately too at the moment, on how do we define, how do we construct, how do we co-construct the identity of any person, let alone an adopted child.
Absolutely.
You're bringing up the conversation of what happens when we have a cross-racial adoption. And you're right, statistically, typically we have black child and white parents. And how does that then how is that made sense between child and parents? And oftentimes there are no real or easy conversations to have to make sense of it. So it's incredibly important that we can think about it and try to make sense of it eventually.
So what are the kinds of conversations that you would advise that parents have with their adoptive kids and their families? I've sharing with you, I won't give the example more specificity because obviously it's private, but I know of one of my friends who is a white woman who grapples a lot with a child that is brown or colored, and I find that interesting. Another friend of mine is also a white couple back in the Eastern Cape, has adopted a black kid, and I think part of what they wrestle with, Zamo, is this question of, if I'm white, English speaking, and this child is, let's say, Xhosa, for example, and I live in the Eastern Cape, do I need to honor their Xhosa heritage? How do we avoid being essentialist about the child, because it's your child? And at the same time, there is a desire to do good and to recognize that a child does come with a certain social history.
Well, I suppose sometimes it's the desire to pretend as if the child comes in a box with a cultural I don't know, something to insert at the age of six, so that they can know their language, know their people, and know etc. etc. And maybe I'm being a bit facetious, because of course that's oftentimes with good intention. Though I think that your question begins with saying, the person you're referencing is trying to grapple with it. And perhaps that's the best starting place, is let's grapple with it. Let's really think about it. Let's speak about it, both with the child as well as perhaps with other professionals who might help you with the conversations. And you know what's interesting is I've found, is both personally and professionally, is that it's oftentimes the adopted child who will bring it up. In a way, much to the horror of the parents and panic of the parents, because they're not ready to speak about it, because they see the difference and want to understand it at a very early age. In fact, that's partly healthy development, is children seeing difference and trying to. And I think parents struggle with that. The part of the struggle might need to confront what is privilege and what is deprivation. So What is it that I have given and can give this child through an adoption, and just being a parent, adoption aside? So what is it that I will never be able to give them? What might I and or the child need to mourn that will never be given, particularly in identity? Look, you can give Xhosa classes, isiZulu classes, where that can be learned. You can give them some sort of historical file to know where they come from and who their parents were, though there are limitations to how much of an identity can be imparted, especially when the limitations start to limit the parent in how much of their own identity they're going to give.
Absolutely.
As if it's not good enough in many ways.
Okay, let's put your headphones on for me. We'll take a couple of calls. Firstly, we've got Brent on the line. Brent, thank you so much for calling us.
Hi, good afternoon. Almost afternoon. Thanks for the enjoyable show. When one listens to all this and there's so many complexities and too many layers, and I'm just listening now. I was adopted, and I only found out very late in life, in my 30s. And I sometimes sort of like have to understand it, and I ended up adopting my wife's first born. Her husband passed away. So, when one starts looking at all this, I think there needs to be an understanding that I know that every person or every couple has a different need to have children for whatever reason, but I don't think we're encouraged enough in our society where there are so many kids out there just to have a home, you know, is paramount. There are so many kids out there, and there are so many people trying to have kids that for years and years they go through so much money in terms of spending to try and have kids and never do. And I just sometimes think that, you know, our system doesn't allow us to encourage people to adopt or to bring people into their own home to know what it's like to be a parent, to be extended, to have that love beyond themselves, you know, because marriage can be very selfish in its own way. But once you start having kids, I mean, you just stop spending money where money needs to be spent and you start spending on the kids. There's an interaction of having kids and having that responsibility and having that love. And I just don't get a sense that we as a society, that there's so much need, and I don't see the authorities encouraging that.
Okay, do you agree with that? Is that true?
The process of adoption is incredibly difficult and can be stifling and in fact eventually impede people from going through with it. And I think that's completely correct. Unfortunately, administratively, we're having really big problems with the adoption process, which is a real pity.
I will take Elaine. We'll come to you in a second. Just a question here from Twitter, from Tando, who says, if I'm a lesbian, single, can I adopt? And how much income should I make? I mean, these are very difficult questions, right?
I'd like to say, Tando, what a pity that you would imagine that the intersectional identities you've included there would prevent you from adopting.
I suspect she's probably wondering how much in real terms, even if not in law, prejudices there are against firstly single parents and maybe even same-sex couples.
In reality, what
does the law say? Do we know?
Absolutely.
And what happens habitually?
In law, there is the prejudice has tried to be washed away. So in the law, in the paper, and what we might read, as we often do in our country, it looks good and it looks good enough. In reality, unfortunately, of course, we will still see prejudice. Hopefully not from the side of the agencies and the processes and procedures otherwise. It's gotten a lot better in that regard.
Let's go to Santon. Elaine, good morning.
Hi, UCBS.
Yes.
I had the most, the happiest moment of my life last week. I've adopted two little girls. And last week, my one little girl said to me, "Mummy, are you very, very, very ugly?" And I was sort of taken aback. And I said, "No, darling, I don't really think I'm very ugly. I suppose it's a matter of opinion, but why are you asking?" And she said, "Because you don't have a beautiful brown skin like mine." And it was just so cute.
How old are they?
One is 5 and 1 is 7. They know where they come from. I know you were talking about,
yes,
you know, how to explain where they come from. And they were a bit upset because I took them to a baby shower. And they said to me, "Mummy, please, next time," and the one was crying, she was 4. She said, "Next time, I want to grow in your tummy." And,
wow,
you know, she didn't really understand it.
Elaine, how do you handle those situations? It sounds to me like a good dash of humor and openness have helped.
Yes, absolutely. And here she really didn't understand. She was too young to understand. So I just said, "Yes, darling, next time you will be." but you know what? You have to have a sense of humor because I get stopped all the time. And they say, and I say, the people will introduce themselves. And I'll say, "Okay, these are my daughters." And they'll look at them and they'll say, "Oh, do you have any children?" And I'll say, "Yes, these are my 2 children." "No, I mean, do you have any real children?"
Jeez.
And I say, "Yes, these are actually real children." And they go, no, but you know what I mean. And I say, no, actually, I don't. Mm. And so that's when I really do lose my sense of humor.
I was about to ask you, and in relation to your children, Elaine, I mean, do you have any anxieties as a mom about protecting them against the same kinds of silly questions, sometimes innocently so, maybe even from kids in the playground and that kind of thing? Do you worry about the world out there or not?
Yes, I actually do. My one little girl was bullied. A little boy at her school said, those aren't your real parents. Your real parents didn't want you. Jeez. And luckily the school did intervene. And hopefully we're in a changing society. You know, I've got a lot of friends who are same-sex couples who've adopted, etc. So for my children, it really is the norm. But we did have the most horrible experience with the second adoption. My little girl, her mother wasn't born in South Africa. Her mother was born in Lesotho. So they classed these children as aliens. Now, what they say is that they can't give them an ID number. So you've adopted them. It's their constitutional right to have an ID number. But the births and deaths registration doesn't allow an ID number to be given because it isn't given at birth. At birth, where they have ID number, it's just crossed out. And so in the end, we had to actually, Lawyers for Human Rights helped me, and we sent a summons to the Minister of Home Affairs, and that's what it took to get an ID number. And so now what's happening is these children who are born of foreign parents aren't being put up for adoption, because it's just too hard for the social workers to deal with. And that's such a tragedy. Mm,
sure. Elaine, thank you so much for sharing with us. There's so much there that I want us to talk to.
I mean, I think there are three things. The first one I won't speak extensively to, which is the amount of work that we still need to do in our home affairs around making adoption for Africans a lot easier. I mean, we speak a lot about decolonization, though when it comes to boundaries and borders, we are a lot more hesitant. Though the other two are where Elaine's four-year-old and seven-year-old are already starting to approach her around where do I come from? And depending on which school you come from, that's an existential, ever-existing question, isn't it? Mm. And kids put it so rawly, and they say, where do I come from? Do I come from your tummy? And within that is a bigger conversation. Do I come from you? Am I of you? Am I of your flesh and blood? Mm. And as painful as that might have been for Elaine, it sounds like it also has a potential of beauty that the little kitty in her mind already imagines that she is of Elaine because of the type and the magic of parenting. The third and one that I want to pick up from Elaine is how at the best of times, we do not afford the parents of adopted children enough support and care and consideration, because there can be incredibly painful experiences, both in the social setting where people do say incredibly insensitive things, as well as within the relationship with your adopted child when you're having these very difficult conversations. And of course, there's deep encouragement there to try and have support.
I often wonder whether it is enough to say, if Elaine, which she sounds like it, is a mom that raises two confident little kids, those kids will naturally have the kind of resilience that will enable them not to have those existential crises as teens. Even as these awkward conversations maybe come up at school, even if they get bullied, even if they get teased. Because children, even born of biological parents, will face difficulties. And the need to be resilient and deal with bullying in its general form is something that all children will go through. Would you agree with that?
Or are
there particularities here that one needs to be even more vigilant about?
Absolutely. And you're completely right. I mean, I suppose the myth that we can perpetuate is that adopted parent children have more or less difficulties. Look, they're very specific and very particular conversations to have, though identity and senses of belonging exist pervasively and ubiquitously with very many people. And there is a potential light at the end of the tunnel or whatever, where in an adoptive experience, the conversation of belonging becomes a lot more relevant and a lot more apparent and a lot more salient, which other couples do not have as well. And just very lastly, on the word of resilience, isn't resilience the kind of the magic, because resilience develops actually at the best of times from really difficult experiences, though the gift of it is that it's something that you can have with pride.
Absolutely. And it doesn't mean that you've chosen those difficulties.
Absolutely.
No one wishes to be bullied or to have your child bullied, but there is an opportunity that comes with that social reality.
Bittersweet.
Absolutely. We've got a couple of more questions here on the SMS line and also on Twitter. And I want to go back to Tandwa's question, because Tandwa says, thank you, but the answer wasn't very clear. I thought Zama was clear. Is there any policy guideline on the question of income, for example? Because that's the other part of the question, right? Not just the question in terms of sexual orientation. Is that a bar to adoption? The answer is clearly no. It must be very hard to know, and I don't know if the state gives guidance from the point of view of the adoption process. How much must I earn before, for example, I'm eligible?
So it's a very... It's a big question when it comes to income, because it considers your income. Do you have a partner? Their income, the household income, living standard measure. What can you provide for this child? And the last time I had a look at it was actually quite lenient and quite accommodating. And I think perhaps where Tando's question is coming from is that in South Africa, we've seen a trend where a lot of affluent or people falling into the upper middle class or upper class are adopting. It is not to say that the law only accommodates or caters for that class to adopt. In addition to that, there might be a comment that I must make in saying that there are also different forms of adoption, in inverted commas, including fostering or being a guardian or a caregiver, which also have different requirements when it comes to income and financial status. Though what the law in its progress and progression has tried to do is be much less discriminatory from a financial economic position for adoptions.
Absolutely. On the SMS line, we've got an interesting, very complicated question here from Anonymous. Anonymous says the following, Zama. On the matter of adoption, why don't they change the law regarding the opening of records? I have two siblings that were adopted in 1962 and have been searching for them for the past 40 years. And clearly this is a source of emotional distress, judging by the excessive number of exclamation marks at the end of that. The powers that be just simply refuse to give any information and help. This is heartbreaking, as I feel that by now, surely as adults, well into our years, we should be able to decide for ourselves whether we want to meet or not. But at least I'll know that they are okay. I mean, there's trauma there, a sense of dislocation, and not just psychological questions, which is your expertise, but close to that, also some really, really complex ethical questions there.
Really complex ethical questions around what should we allow and what should we not, especially when it comes to identity and anonymity on both sides, which never has any sort of a real or clear answer. And the law, I suspect, is on the side of protection of personal information on either side, which can be tragic when the one person wants to reach out to the other side and does not know if the other person does or does not. You know, it really is it's a Greek tragedy in many ways. The one other thing that we can see there is a depersonalization that happens or can happen with adoption, is how do I know myself if I do not know the people of me? And eventually that has a risk of allowing the person not to know themselves, or resulting in the person not knowing themselves because of the human experience of needing to be known in self through another. How do I get to experience myself is oftentimes through another person. So it becomes a fulfillment, not just of you, though really a fulfillment.
You know, it's so fascinating
myself.
What you're saying. It touches closely to a topic we might do next week, I think, Maha, if not the week after, which is kinship and biology, and how friends can be a source of family. particularly for those of us who sometimes have relationships that have been impaired with our biological relatives. But this question from Anonymous seems to suggest, to put it plainly, that, you know, blood is thicker than water, that there's still a yearning there. And I don't know if these are social constructions, but that some people still want to know what happened to, you know, my biological sibling.
And it's a very good question that many, many people have. At the risk of saying too much, sometimes that question has an idealized answer that really I will find myself when I find my parents.
Kumbulekaya.
Exactly. And Kumbulekaya shows the tragedy of
Absolutely.
What happens when we idealize that too much and not. Because sometimes you find yourselves when you realize how different you are to family and. So I guess part of what I'm saying is the analysis of what is it that you're looking for too when you say you're looking for your biological family might help quench a little bit of that thirst or maybe a lot of it. Basically, not all of it.
Absolutely. Some wonderful tweets. Matt says, podcast, please. We will, Matt. Don't worry. You can find it at 702.co.za. Danae is already on top of it. Very efficient here. Hey, putting Thomas to shame. And Matt says, and I missed most of the discussion, but fascinating. And don't worry, you CBS. I'm not just saying that because your guest is well-spoken. Ben says, why is it so expensive for a couple to adopt? I think it just goes back to the very honest answer that Zama gave, which is when the state can make certain policy proposals, then it simply does. And the fact that it can't stop us by being intrusive in terms of, you know, a couple actually deciding to have kids, even if it's not prudent for them to do so, quote unquote, doesn't mean that the state shouldn't have guidelines when it can actually regulate. That's just the reality of it. Let's go to Santon and squeeze in one more call. Dumi, good morning.
Morning. How are you? You serious?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Listen, I just have one question. Is it important to tell adopted children that they are adopted? And the reason I ask this question, I have, we've got family friends of ours who adopted two little children, but the mother actually pretended to be with child for the whole 9 months to protect the children from her family from finding out that they're adopted, and they have no plans to actually tell the children that they're adopted.
That's a tough one. We've got about 90 seconds.
I very certainly cannot comment on whether that was the right or wrong thing to do. I can ask questions on what was being protected against, and was it the children that were being protected, or was it the family itself, and what that might mean for them that someone adopted. And I do not think anyone can ever say yes or no to that question. I do think that overall the basis of it is what's the best thing for the adopted children. And there may be some pain initially in trying to have a conversation around the fact that you did not come from my tummy. Though what we also know is that that's not the overall and the everything that makes us kin, is it not? And in fact, it might even allow for other more beautiful conversations around the fact that you were not my kin, though it was you that I chose. And look, I'm just putting,
absolutely.
That's just one
absolutely.
Of them.
Look, I think what it also opens up, right? And maybe, I don't know, maybe the next time you come on, here's a topic for us to delve into that Dumi just sparked in me, which goes way beyond do I tell the child that he or she was adopted, which of course is family secrets.
Family secrets.
Why we have them, why we generate them, and whether or not to release ourselves from the web of secrets that we have in our families. And we all have them. So maybe that we can do that next time. But on this one, Zama, you've been incisive as ever. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's always great to be here.